The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
It's Lifeline with Craig Roberts. He's the host of Northern California's longest-running conservative talk show. He's a man with a message, a conservative with compassion. He's Lifeline's own Craig Roberts.
Good afternoon, Northern California. Welcome. Just about 5 minutes after the hour, 5 p.m., as we welcome you to another edition of Lifeline. Keeping you company Monday through Friday at this time, as we typically do, addressing issues that impact your life, your world, and your Christian walk. Somewhat innocuous sounding, or obnoxious as the case may be, sounding bit of music might seem to have come from some major Hollywood spectacle, or maybe even serve as a great theme song for this show some days. But in fact, it is the theme from one of the best-selling video games of all time, Call of Duty. And I've always marveled at those that will talk about what a wonderful teaching tool that computers can be, or television, and that children can watch a program like Nat Geo and come back with all kinds of great facts, and having expanded their horizons and understanding of life and the world, and how engaging the computer can be as an educational tool. And yet, out of the very same mouths will come, "Well, there's no influence whatsoever of violent video games on children. How can you dare even suggest such a thing?" Well, which is it going to be, folks? Can media, in particular television and interactive games and so forth, can they teach children? Or are they not teachers at all? Joining me now with some insights is Dr. Jane Anderson. She served for many years as a pediatrician at Mount Zion Center for UCSF. And Dr. Anderson, always a delight and an education to have you join us on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
What about this debate? I never have quite understood, Dr. Anderson, how we can, out of one side of our mouth, suggest that television and computers are a wonderful teaching tool, and the other one say that they, at the same time, have no influence on children who will spend sometimes hundreds of hours over the course of a month engrossed in violent video games that have no other purpose than racking up points, killing people.
Exactly. It's sort of why do companies spend $2.5 million for a 30-second commercial on the Super Bowl if they don't think it's going to influence our behavior?
Precisely.
So the interesting thing for me is that there is so much new information on brain research. And researchers are now using brain scanning tools such as MRIs to evaluate children and teenagers before and after and sometimes during the time that they're playing video games to see what happens. So we now have real brain data that shows that areas of our brain that are linked to desensitization to violence are activated during violent video games. We have more longitudinal studies that show us that children who play more video games are more likely to engage in violent behavior. And it doesn't mean that every child who plays video games is going to end up more aggressive, but it certainly plays into the tendencies, and there are a lot of reasons for it. Violence during video games is not just learned and demonstrated, it is repetitively practiced over and over again until you get it right. And then that violence is rewarded, so you get to go to higher levels, or you get expanded tools of violence, so you get rewarded for your behavior. And so the violence becomes justified and it becomes, quote, fun. And then worse than that, it's what we call many of the games, like Call of Duty, Mortal Kombat, others, Doom. They are first-person player video games. In other words, when we think of Pac-Man, it was like take a joystick and make the little Pac-Man guy move. You weren't actually Pac-Man, but the first-person player games, you are actually the player, and you see the world through the player's eyes. And that's why some of the school shooters had never held guns before. The kids in, I believe it was Mississippi, in Pearl, Mississippi, that student had never held a gun before, but he'd practiced on video games, and so he was able to have direct hits to students who were running, but he got them with one shot and killed them, which is, better than most, police agencies or soldiers can do, but he'd been practicing.
Well, and we've seen cases where military, including our own, are extremely interested in talking to potential recruits who have very high marks in video gaming, because these same individuals who, as you point out, often have no experience shooting an actual weapon whatsoever, and yet when the gun is put into their hands for the first time, demonstrate remarkable levels of marksmanship. Why? Because the ability to load, reload, aim, and so forth, they've practiced all of that sometimes thousands and times over. I mean, in often cases, Dr. Anderson, I would imagine, just in terms of overall experience, albeit not with a real weapon, but still, their level of experience is equal to or exceeds even what the police get on the firing range.
Oh, sure. I mean, one of the studies is from 2004, so it's old now, but boys between 8 and 13 years of age were playing 13 hours a week of video games, and most of those are violent. So although not all video games are violent, 10 of the top 20 game sellers are violent. And it is a multi-billion dollar industry, $11.7 billion. We're spending, so I always like to tease and say, don't tell me we don't have enough money to do X, Y, Z.
Excellent point. You make reference to a number of these studies that are out there, the growing body of evidence that suggests that, of course, there's a connection to violence after they've seen and been programmed by this kind of so-called entertainment. I'm curious to find out what the brainwave activity is showing. And most importantly, what needs to be the warning word here? Even after the heels of events like Sandy Hook, we're teaching our children that violence is entertainment. In real life, when we engage in wars that we do, we teach our children that that's the way adults settle disputes. And then when our kids grow up and turn the guns on us or act out violently against us, we wonder what happened to little Johnny, that maybe because he wasn't breastfed as a child, he's acting this way. We've trained these kids to behave like this. Why are we as a society surprised? Rhetorical question. Better put, what can we who understand it and get it do to overcome all of this? We'll continue with more of our conversation with Dr. Jane Anderson as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
So the $5 or $6 billion a year video gaming industry says that their entertainment has no influence on children and violent activity whatsoever. Of course, they would probably have upwards of 5-6 billion reasons why they would say that. Dr. Jane Anderson with us today with a bit contrarian insight on this topic. Dr. Anderson, you mentioned about this growing body of evidence, and I know there have literally been thousands of studies that have tied in the impact of prolonged exposure to violent video games and the degree to which children who have a history of that as a form of entertainment, acting out an aggressive behavior, involvement in a violent manner with the authorities, so on and so forth. What's the response to all of this? What should it be? I mean, we've been talking about this for years and years and years. Outside of parents waking up to certain realities, is it time for the government to begin interceding here and saying, you know what, just like we won't allow kids to see certain classifications of movies, we're not going to allow them to engage in certain classifications of violent video games?
Well, as much as I'm a conservative politically and I don't like government intrusion generally, I think if we compare it to, just like you said, you know, if we compare it to like accessing alcohol or pornography or going into an X-rated movie, I think we can set some limits on children and adolescents. They are still under adult sort of authority and I hate to use the word control, but should be under control. So I think, yes, you know, California tried it. They passed a law to limit the access of teenagers to the most mature rating or the most violent video games, but it was defeated by the Supreme Court as a right to freedom of speech. But I think if we can limit, you know, sale of pornography, I think we can limit the sale of violent video games. But I really would encourage parents, until that time, they really have to be aware of the violence in the video games. And a lot of times it's not noticeable at the lower levels. If they're sitting next to their, you know, teenager, they need to see, well, what's at the higher levels? And I want to really point out to all parents that boys are so susceptible. The way the boys' brains develop and their exposure to testosterone in utero at 12 weeks gestation, their brains develop differently, and they learn by competition and repetition, and that's exactly what video games are. So they're much more likely to become addicted and be influenced by the video games. So for everybody, limit them, but especially for boys. And, you know, even parents of toddlers out there, the parents of toddlers who are listening, and you're probably thinking, oh, well, you know, my kid's not affected by this. You know, you're handing them your iPad, your iPhone to keep them entertained, you know, while you're in the car or at the doctor's office, and you are teaching them that screen time is entertaining, and you're not doing what we used to do as parents, talking to them while you're, you know, in the car and playing word games and I spy out the window and, you know, helping them be creative and problem solve. And when they're at home, get outdoors and do things outdoors. There's so much that of life that our children are missing out on because they're indoors playing video games. So I'd really encourage parents to be aware. Keep computers, video games, consoles, everything out of the kids' bedrooms. We have documented evidence that children who have computers and TVs and games and stuff in their bedrooms, they do worse in school, they have more problems with obesity, they sleep less, they have more behavioral problems. It's like there are things that parents can do.
You know, and the other thing that dawns on me is you were sharing the notion of not engaging children in the healthy way, that kids of my generation, we had no choice. None of this stuff existed in those days. I think we barely had the electric light. But we tend to then train kids to be very inward-looking as opposed to outward-looking. There's no sense of wonder and awe about the world around them. It's all limited to, you know, the 13-inch diagonally measured screen of the computer in front of them. And, you know, I think that you know, not only leads to a tremendous degree of a false, distorted, sort of just two-dimensional view of the world, in spite of the best efforts at 3D, but then, too, Dr. Anderson, I mean, isn't there a degree to which there is a chemical high that kids get off of this, not just as they're advancing and they're making more points and they're able to, you know, engage in more points for more kills and things of this sort, but aren't we kind of, there's got to be sort of a brain chemical reaction to engaging in this violence through a video game?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's where addictions come in, and there are definitely, you know, teenagers who, and young, especially young men who are addicted to video games, and the addiction comes from the pleasurable response. And unfortunately, there's like a gate in our brain, and it's only going to let through certain sensations. So, for instance, if I'm sitting here, I'm not paying attention necessarily to where my feet are or what smells are in the room or whatever. The brain determines what is sensational, what is new, what is innovative and creative, and it lets those sensations through, which is why you have to have sort of different, more creative, worse violence at the higher levels using worse weapons, because that keeps that excitement and that adrenaline going, and it allows your brain to take in that sensation, and then it stimulates your dopaminergic system, and that's what contributes to this need for more and more.
No, just as much as we see the same thing played out in real life, that oftentimes children who engage or adults who engage in violent behavior then need to go higher and higher and higher in order to receive sort of the same kind of chemicals and enjoyment out
of it. That's exactly right.
So it ought to be easy for parents to connect the dots, folks. So let's start connecting the dots. Now, urging our government at the state level and federal level to start putting bans and restrictions and tighter controls on this, age restrictions, things of that sort, is very important. But I guess at the end of the day, Dr. Anderson, it really comes down to the parents, doesn't it?
It really does. And the video game industry does have ratings on the video game, so pay attention. You know, look on the box. You know, does it say E for everyone, or does it say M for mature audiences only? And it will say on there if it's sexual, if it's violent, if it's, you know, if there's foul language, it'll say on there. So look and read. Teenagers tell you their parents might set rules for the TV viewing, but they don't set rules for video game playing. Well, set some rules and set some guidelines. Meet with the teenagers. Hey, what do you think you're doing when you're playing video games? What activities are you not participating in? Oh, you know, you're not outdoors exercising and playing on a team. And boys, by the way, learn so much about the real world by playing on a sports team. So, you know, get your, and girls do too, but boys more so, get your guys out there playing, you know, reading, being creative. You know, it used to be kids would go outdoors and create the rules to a game, and they'd be creative. You know, you be this, I'll be that. And now it's just, you know, I'll sit here and sit side by side with my friend, and we'll both, you know, play video games together. It's like, no, there are so many wonderful alternatives, and the evidence is overwhelming in so many arenas of life, whether it's the physical development of the child, the emotional development, the cognitive development, even developing empathy and compassion. Our brains develop that by looking at someone else's facial expression. Well, you can't see those changes when you're in front of a screen.
How far we've come from the day and age when I was a kid and they couldn't get us to come back indoors, and today we can't get them to go outdoors. Our thanks to Dr. Jane Anderson for being with us in this segment of Lifeline.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
If you are a fan of many of the travel magazines that are out there, or perhaps like to watch National Geographic as they take you into these faraway exotic places that are often filled with jungles and wild animals and so forth, you think, what a fascinating part of the world. But don't tell me that people really live there, do they? Oh, not only do they really live there, but in fact, some have adopted it as home. Joining me today in studio, no stranger to the KFAX microphones, he is the founder of Living Waters Village, all the way from Borneo, and we're delighted to have Ronnie Habor with us once again. And Ronnie, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Craig.
You are gracious to be with us. I'll mention for our listeners that you have just had a lengthy flight, literally halfway across the world. It was about a 15-hour trip, I guess.
I think a bit more. I think it was 24 altogether.
24 hours. And then with the sleep deprivation, we invite you into our studios to tell your story. But we're delighted that you're here, and great to see you again. And wonderful to have the opportunity for you to share with our listeners what God is doing in this part of the world in Indonesia. These are stories that we watch on travel magazines, and we are fascinated by the people, the culture, what these islands look like. But to imagine somebody who travels from a very developed part of the world, Australia, and says, God is calling me and my family to go to what many would consider to be the uttermost parts of the earth and go and plant a ministry there for children. Minister to them, rescue them, educate them, bring them into an environment where they can hear the good news. This is really literally what you have been doing for 20-something years now.
Yeah, 21 years, yeah.
How did God first open that door? How did God take the young man originally from the Netherlands and transplant it into Australia all the way down to Borneo with a wife and children and decide, this is where, son, I want you planted to share my good news?
Well, that's a long story, but I'll condense it as quick as possible. I'm actually an Australian, but when I was 8, I went to Holland. My parents are Dutch, and then they decided to go to Holland when I was 8 years old, so we did. I was educated there, spent there 10 years, didn't like it there, never liked it there. A lot of things, horrible things happened there, but I always dreamt of going back to Australia, which I did when I was 18. I went back by myself. There, eventually, a couple of years later in Australia, I got married and with a Dutch lady, so that was good. There were some good things in Holland after all. And then I got saved. That's a long story as well, but God got a hold of me. And when God got a hold of me, I realized that there was a purpose in my life that I didn't think there was before. And so this gap was filled in my life, and I was absolutely radically changed as a result of God coming into my life, allowing him to saturate me and to wanting to use me. And I realized that God had a purpose and a plan for my life. And it was just so awesome. I just wanted to tell the whole world. And so I knew that I wasn't just meant to be staying in Australia, working in a factory, helping out with the church there, but God had bigger plans. I didn't know what, where, how, when. I didn't know that, but I just knew that God wanted us to prepare ourselves for whatever he had for us. So I lost my first wife in a car accident, and then after that I married again, and then both of us really felt that we need to give up everything, and God called us to give up everything and to just follow him. And so we really didn't know where to go. He called us to go to Borneo, but it wasn't clear really. He didn't write it all out on a piece of paper for us, all the things that were going to happen. I think if he would have done that, we probably would have run the other way like Jonah and would have said, you know, call somebody else, but that's not us. But just as well, I mean, God knows your level of faith, and he's there to stretch your faith. It does require of us to be obedient to the Lord and everything, and to be serious with God. It is not just, yes, I believe in God and that's it, and then you just go and do your own thing. But here, hey God, here I am. I want to serve you. My life is yours. You bought it with an expensive price. So I want to really do your will while I'm here. And I realized that my first wife, she was 31 when she died in a car accident. And I thought, you know, she didn't know when she was going to die that day. And I thought, I don't know when I'm going to die. I might have a week to live, a month to live, 10 years, 50 years, whatever it is. It's still only a short speck, you know, compared to eternity. And so, but I want to make a difference. I want to really serve God. I don't want to run after money. I don't want to run after position or power or anything like that. I just want to please my God. I want to be obedient to him. And so both of us, we decided that that's what we want. And then God opened the door for us in Borneo.
Now, I'm curious about that because, of course, close proximity to all of that wonderful, amazing chain of islands, I think 17,000 all told within Indonesia stretching through that part of the world. But Borneo, I mean, some people would say, well, you're there in Australia. Why not be called by God to Perth or Sydney or Melbourne?
Yeah, a lot of people go to the Sunshine Coast. It's the paradise of Australia. You know?
Great they place all get to called minister. There. That's yeah. it. Yeah, it's like here, you go to Hawaii. God's you're called right. me to missions. Field.
If you say, God, here I am, use me however which way, then you need to be prepared for that. So that's what we said. Excuse me. And so we then, when Borneo opened up, we said, okay, God, well, I don't even know where Borneo is really, but whatever you say. And so we then did a reconnaissance trip over there with a friend of mine, and I went there for my friend, not for me really, but for my friend who had a real burden to go to one of the other islands of Indonesia. But God said in an all-night prayer meeting one day, a couple of weeks before we left, I want you to go to Borneo and visit these people there. So we ended up going there, and when I arrived there, I got off the flight there in Pontianak, my heart started to race like anything, and it was as if I came home. I had the same feeling when I came back from Holland, coming back to Australia, dreaming of this moment for 10 years, being back in my own country, and my heart started to race, and I felt really like I'm home again. And I had the same experience when I came to Pontianak, and I said to God, I'm not here for me, I'm here for him, I'm here for my friend. But it became clear that God was telling me, well, you've been asking, you know, where do you want me to come to? I said, well, God said, this is where I want you to come, you and Kay to come. So I kept it to myself until I got back home. And then I said to my wife, I really believe that God is saying that we had to pack our bags and to go to Borneo. And she goes, great, when are we going?
Wow.
So she was ready. She knew that.
But what about your children now? You had, were they teenagers at the time?
My daughter was 18. My son, Paul, was 11. And our youngest at that time, Nathaniel, was one.
Now, that's kind of startling news to deliver to the family. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, Dad and Mom are heading off to Borneo here in the where? But you're coming with us. How did the children first react to that?
Well, they already knew that any day, any moment, God could call us wherever, to Russia, China, who knows where. So they already knew that that was coming one day. Our daughter didn't. She was 18, and she decided that she wasn't going to go. And she had her own life there in Australia, so she was continued to study there. So we'd have to behind, which was a real difficult decision to make. But
sure.
But we felt that God was in control and he was looking after her, so that was okay. Paul was 11, and it was a very difficult time for him because he had to leave his school and friends behind. In one sense, he wanted the adventure, you know, going to somewhere unknown and, hey, this will be cool. On the other side of the coin, he didn't want to leave his friends and his known world.
And you're going to a place where the culture is different, the language is different, the surroundings are different. There's nothing or very little, I would imagine, there in Borneo that seemed to at all be a reminder of what life must have been like back home in Australia.
Yeah, it was very, very different. And for the first year, of course, then you realize how incredibly different you are. And with my son in particular, you know, he's 11, 12 years old, 11 when we went there. But I remember one day we were with the tribal people. The tribal people there are the Dayaks, and they're animists. So they believe in all sorts of spirits and all sorts of things. And we were at this longhouse where from the Iban tribe, and they had a celebration. They just opened up this new longhouse that they built because their previous one had burned down. And it's a whole community lives in one house, one longhouse. So you have 30 to 50 families living in the one house. Unfortunately, if somebody cooks their meal in their little section of the building and it gets on fire, the whole village actually loses their accommodation. And so but this is what happened. They built a new one, and they came and asked us whether we would come and bless the new building. So we did, and my son was there, and we were sitting opposite the tribal chief, and he kept on staring at my son. He was a good-looking guy, good-looking kid, and he had this chain around his neck with a shark tooth on it. And the tribal chief kept on staring at my son, and he says to me in his language, he said, "How much do you want for him, for that?" And he pointed to my son, but I thought he was pointing to his necklace.
No, he meant, "How much do you want to sell your son?
I thought he was pointing to his necklace. So I said, "Oh, that's his. That you'll have to ask him. You know, I don't know whether he wants to sell it." He goes, "You're the father?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, how much do you want for him?" I said, "For my son." He said, "Yes, I want to buy your son." I said, "You want to buy my son?" And so my son then realized something was going on. He couldn't understand the language. He said, "What is he saying, Dad?" I said, "Hang on a minute. He wants to buy you. Just wait a minute." So he grabbed a hold of my arm and he goes, "Dad, don't say anything foolish yet." I said, "Just hang on a minute. We're negotiating here." Yeah. So, you know, joking a little bit. But at the same time, I realized this is quite serious. Because I said to him, "Why do you want to buy my son?" "Is it for my daughter in marriage?" I said, "He's 12 years old." He said, "Yes. My daughter is 12 years old as well, or 13. And he said, "That would be a good match." And I said, "He's not for sale." He said, "Why not?" I said, "Well, he's not for sale." And then I realized, oh, gosh, I need to watch out what I say here, because any moment you can, you know, by nodding the wrong way or saying the wrong thing or doing another expression or something, a deal has been made. So, and I thought, my goodness, how different our cultures are, you know. Mm-hmm. We just would never think of something like that, but... I still tease my son with that sometimes, as, you know, years after, I say, "Misbehave." I still can make a deal.
Out there. If you've just joined us today, in studio with us is Ronnie Habor. He is the founder of Living Waters Village. By the way, you can find out more about this amazing ministry, yes, indeed, right in the heart of Borneo, by going online to livingwatersvillage.org. That's livingwatersvillage.org. The story of the miracle zone in the jungles of Borneo is the title of Ronnie's book, co-authored with a very dear friend of ours, Pastor Don Shealy from Church of the Highlands. And if you want to get information about the book, you can check it out again online at livingwatersvillage.com. That's livingwatersvillage.com. We'll take a brief time out and come back to more of our conversation as this edition of Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
And welcome back to The Conversation. With us today in studio, a very special guest from a very special part of the world. Ronnie Habor is with us. He is the co-author of a new book called Miracle Zone in the Jungles of Borneo, co-authored with Church of the Highland Zone Pastor Don Shealy. By the way, you can hear Pastor Don weekday mornings at 6:30 a.m. for Daybreak right here on KFAX. Ronnie Habor, founder of Living Waters Village, sharing this amazing story of traveling literally from Australia to the jungles of Borneo simply because God said, go. And as you went, Ronnie, I'm curious, was there any particular agenda in mind? In other words, some people say, okay, we have a vision here to plant a church, or we're going to build a medical facility, things of this sort. What is it that God had put in your mind, or had he even crystallized any specific thoughts in terms of what exactly, now you know to where you've been called, did you understand how or why?
Oh, absolutely not. God did sort of show us that we would, I mean, these people need salvation, so obviously it's bringing the gospel message to them,
sure,
somehow, some way, and then plant churches there and whatever. So that, with that in mind, we sort of left there, and we started there already straight away when we come to Kuching on the Malaysian side of Borneo, and started there first, and then worked in the Malaysian side of Borneo, plus traveling over the border into the Indonesian side of Borneo. And the people groups are the same. There's 400 different tribal groups belonging to the Dayaks, and they all have their own culture, their own language, and some are more primitive than others. Some are already quite civilized. They live around the coastal areas, but a lot of them in the interior are still quite primitive, and still even today they're still quite remote and primitive.
Now, I'm curious, across that arc within the Dayak population, though, are they all predominantly all animists?
The Dayaks are predominantly animist. I mean, there are some that have become Muslim, some have become Christian, some are Catholic, but the majority are animistic, yeah. And so we believe that it was our task to sort of, you know, start planting churches, which we did in the beginning. But then as we started to see all the misery that was going on, particularly on the Indonesian side, because the Malaysian side, they were fairly well looked after by the government in many ways. And the Indonesian side was a different story altogether. The further that you went into the remote areas, the more misery that we experienced there. And the more difficult it was often to bring the gospel to them because of all the poverty that you saw there. But at the same time, God sort of challenged us there to do something about it. Because I just kept on saying, God, this just doesn't make sense. We're trying to, you know, bring the gospel to these people, bring Jesus to these people, bring you to them. But how this poverty seems so huge, so fast. How can we change this? And so we started to see all these kids that were neglected and nobody wanted, especially orphans. They were neglected because if families can't look after their own kids, they haven't got enough food to look after their own children, then even more so for the orphans in their villages, they're sort of disregarded and left on their own.
They're literally just abandoned,
yeah.
And they fend for themselves. Yeah. I mean, we hear terms like street kids here in America. These kids are literally just sort of sent off and wish you luck, and they're on their own to do as best as they can.
Yeah. So, and they're, of course, sometimes they can survive, especially if they're strong. But when if they're weak and already sick and all that, then they won't survive. You see, over there in the jungles, you'd think there'd be enough food there everywhere. You'd think that the trees, they produce enough fruits and roots and all that sort of stuff. But the thing is, sometimes there is no fruit at all for a whole year. Sometimes they have two crops or three crops a year, and sometimes they have nothing for a whole year. And so when the families of these tribes, they use their seeds for growing rice the next year. They use that up because they're hungry. Then they know that the next year they're going to starve. And so that's when you'll see a lot of children will actually die of starvation and will be abandoned. And you see some dreadful situations, particularly like girls when they're 11, 12 years old and they get their first period. They're married off to these old ghastly guys who want another wife. So the witch doctor then marries them off, makes a deal with these guys. In exchange for a couple of pigs, the parents will get a couple of pigs for their daughter, and their daughters are married off. And you see these little girls pregnant already straight away, and by the time they're 20, they've already had 4, 5, 6 kids. Half of them are dead from neglect, and the other half are neglected, you know, because they have no concept of love. That's gone out the window already a couple of generations. So all these kids that we get now in our place, many of them have no concept of love at all.
No, you're really coming to a scenario where it seems as if when we talk about traveling to anywhere to share the good news of the gospel, and of course at the very core of that is enveloped by this tremendous way in which God has demonstrated his love toward us, his willingness to look past our sin, to ultimately sacrifice his only son so that we might walk in fellowship with him, have our sins be forgiven, have that sense of connectivity between creator and creation. And so at the core of the message of the gospel is this profound love. Absolutely. That God is shown toward us, and yet you come into this scenario as you're describing, Ronnie, and you think, you know, we're here trying to present this other spirit, in a sense, since this is the animist viewpoint is that there's spirits that reside in everything. A tree has a spirit, the rock has a spirit, etc. You're coming to describe to and share with the Dyak people this other spirit who is at the core a loving spirit, yeah. And yet you look at the depravity and the circumstances in which they're living and the kind of suffering, particularly amongst these kids, it seems to me as if you're really compelled to have to do something to address these immediate felt needs. I mean, you see a kid starving and say, well, wait, before you die, let me tell you about Jesus. What?
Yeah, and that would mean totally nothing to them. I mean, if you would just say to a dying kid who's starving, look, Jesus loves you, and I love you too, and let me pray for you right now. I don't think
he's talking
iota about what you're just saying. But if you take that kid in, and you care for that child, and you love that child as if he was your own, then very quickly that child will know who Jesus is after you share that with him.
You and your wife, Kay, began doing just that.
Yeah.
And some might say now, 20 years later, it kind of grew out of hand. this Living Waters Village has absolutely taken off. And it went from maybe a small size, let's have a vision that we can handle here, to a vision that I would imagine has gone absolutely beyond anything you could have ever dreamt or thought of in those early days.
Well, again, it was just God showing us that God doesn't give you the whole full story yet because he knows where you're at with your faith. That's why I said I would have run away like Jonah did. But the thing is, he gives you just enough to be able to handle and to stretch your faith a little bit more. So it was a process that God took through us, with us, that hey, do I really believe that God is God, who says he is, and that he can do anything? You know, a lot of people believe in God, but I come across so many Christians today that don't believe really that God can do anything anymore.
He can do some things, but there are limits.
That's yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas that's not the case. If God created the heavens and the earth and he created mankind and we're so complex put together, he can create anything. He can do anything. Now, God rescued my two children when they were in a car accident with my first wife, miraculously. And I knew from that day, if God can do this, you know, against all odds, I mean, even the neurologist said to me, it's absolutely impossible that your children could survive this. And yet they survived and they pulled through and they're healed completely. That if God can do that, he can do anything. And so God was already working in our lives, showing us that, hey, you know, I can do anything. But do you believe that? And do you, and, you know, and not just believe it. How do I know that you that your faith is real? Is by testing you on your faith. So then you're required to step out in your faith as well, and do the things that God has asked you to do. So do I really believe then? When the Lord told us a number of years later, when we already had a number of kids in our house, look, I want you now to prepare a place for 1,000 neglected children and build schools for 2,000. Now, we didn't have a cent to do that, and we didn't have the resources to do that, the people to do that, but I just knew that when God said, do that, we just have to start doing that.
It occurs to me, Ronnie, that this is not just then simply a matter of having the kind of belief that God is capable of doing these things. But then this concept of surrender really needs to enter in too, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Surrender in the sense that, okay, we know that God can do it, but are we willing to turn over everything to him to allow him to do it, take my control, my ideas out of the picture, so to speak, and just say, okay, God,
absolutely,
we're surrendering to you.
Yes.
Wow, that takes your faith to a whole different level, doesn't it?
When the Lord told us in Australia, and Kay and I were pretty well off. We were well set. We had plenty of money. We had our own house paid off. We had no debt. So we're quite young still. I was only 32, and we had all this stuff. We had good jobs, good paid jobs, good church, family there, and all that. And then God told us to pack up, sell up, and follow him. And so we did. And so now I always say to people, you know, I had all this money and I had all this stuff, you know, that I could just grab a hold of. I said, but now I've got nothing. I don't have a house or land or anything, no pension, no retirement fund or nothing. I said, but I'm richer today than I've ever been in my life. Why? Because I think, I believe that we've learned to surrender it over to God. If God says, you know, I want you to trust in me. I want you to do this. This is what you've asked me. Well, I'm giving you this task. Now it's up to you whether you'll be successful in this. It's not up to God. God is already there, and He's already there, ready to bless you. And this is why I always say, you know, many, many Christians don't realize that their obedience to God will actually save and bless many other people. And if we don't obey God once He's asked us to do something, then actually a lot of people are going to miss out because of our disobedience. That's a scary prospect. That's a scary thing. See, all of us are going to stand before the throne of God one day, and we're all going to have to give an account. And what are we going to say to the Lord? I don't want to be in that position where He's going to be so disappointed with me because I didn't do what He asked me to do. You know, like I said, we're only here for a small, short moment in this planet, in this life. You know, and so, but what are we going to do with it? And as a Christian, isn't that correct when we've asked Jesus to come into our lives that we've actually surrendered everything over to Him? Not just the things that we want to surrender, but everything. So my life, my time, my resources, my family, my everything to Him. And then I should, so I'm here then for His business. God's business is people that are saved, people that are lost, mankind. And I want to make sure that, you know, I don't want to people around the world to say, oh, Ronnie, well done, you know, you've started this off, you've been obedient to the Lord, rah, rah, rah. I want people to come to know Christ. And these kids now are coming to know Christ. I've got kids now that are in Bible college. 25 of them are now in Bible college. They want to be pastors and church planters. I've got 34 in universities around Indonesia. They're our teachers. We at school, just saying to Pastor Tony, we're starting up with our senior high school this year, which is a major step of faith. But again, every year we see miracle after miracle happen by just stepping out of faith, trusting in God for everything, and God comes through every time. And also all our teachers, all 37 that we have at our school now, are all our own kids that have come through the ranks, and we send them off to university, have come back, and now are helping out with the next generation. So I think that's awesome to see God working in these lives. And that's what it's all about, is to rescue mankind, rescuing those that desperately need Christ. And that's everywhere. That's the whole world. I mean, the people, there are unsaved people all over the world. And that's why we need, if we don't do that, if we don't obey God, you know, who else is going to do it? Didn't He ask us to do it?
So, absolutely. We are to be the conduit through which His Spirit flows and works and moves amongst people to impact lives with the good news of the
gospel. Too much today, I think we sort of look at what are my rights and what are, you know,
What can God do for me? That's, I mean, right. It's not enough to say that He saved you. And now it's like, okay, let's regard God as our big cosmic bellhop and see what He can go do for us. We're going to pause on that point. Come back to more of our conversation with Ronnie Habor of Living Waters Village. More information, by the way, on the web at livingwatersvillage.com. That's livingwatersvillage.com. The book is called Miracle Zone in the Jungles of Borneo, written by Ronnie Habor and co-authored by Don Shealy, Pastor Don from Church of the Highlands in San Bruno. A brief timeout, back with more of the conversation as Lifeline continues.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.